Okay.
What's the name of this show, D?
This show's called Music Mindfulness and Madness. I'm Richard Henry Madden III, Esquire, phoning in from beautiful Selwood, the Selwood neighborhood in Portland, Oregon, where the weather's finally nice. Skated this morning. It was good. Who are you? Who are you again?
I'm Michael Haley. Michael Haley from the City of Studios, Studio City, California.
City of Studios.
Artist, recording artist, producer, yes. Songwriter.
Yes.
And amongst other things.
Has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh, God. I should be so lucky. I should spend $30,000 to have that happen. I should be so lucky.
I know. People pay for that shit.
Someone has to
get that shit done.
It's about 30 grand from what I understand.
Is it really?
Yeah, I have a friend who, his buddy got a star on the Walk of Fame. And he didn't want to pay for it. He's like, I'm not going to pay for that bullshit. And so he had like some film company. They wanted him to do the movie. They said, okay, we'll do the movie, but you got to pay for that star. And they went, okay, fine.
I've heard interviews with people and I've heard stories like that. Just someone says, hey, you should do this. And they go, yeah, I'm not paying for it. And someone else pays for it.
Who's this other guy here?
I don't know. I gotta say, I am beside myself right now, just beside myself with excitement. Because I was telling you, I have wanted to do this with this magical person ever since before we had the podcast, I think, because you know, all the hubbub about spatial audio started bubbling up. And right around the time we started this, and I was like, hey, remember that guy that worked at AID? Do you still know that guy? Can we get him? And you said, yeah, well, I'm still friends with him. I can talk to him. and he's here. He's in the house. Anu Kirk, on the infamous Anu Kirk,
star of stage and screen.
Also has his own star on Hollywood Boulevard.
He does. He actually did
Anu Kirk.
He was gifted by the city. No, yes. I don't have a bio for Mr. Anu. I don't know if Anu would grace us with a bio of your
I don't even know where you're working now, Anu.
Exceptional
Michael
skills.
Michael's not a very good friend. He hasn't told me much about what it is you're doing now exactly.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's really nice to be here and talking to both of you. My name's Anu Kirk. As far as a short bio goes, I'm originally from the Washington, D.C. area. Went to a fancy college and got a degree in economics and promptly moved to Los Angeles to be a rock star in the 90s, which is where I met Michael.
Yay, rock stars.
I spent the 90s playing in bands and working in recording studios and producing and engineering and doing a little bit of film and TV scoring and basically every kind of job you can think of to try to make it as a musician. And at the end of the 90s, I had gone through some stuff. I got married and divorced and was sort of at a place where I felt a little burnt out on the music business or trying to make it. And I had helped some friends of mine up in the Bay Area get a startup going. And they asked me to move up to the Bay Area to be a product manager for this startup. And it was a great opportunity. So I did. And long story short, we created Rhapsody, which was the world's first music subscription service.
Oh, shit, for real?
Yeah, I did the product design and product management, and then I spent, and in fact, I am the person who coined the term music subscription service.
Holy, that was the first service that I ever used.
Yeah, because it was the first one.
It was the first one.
And I spent...
Shame on you, Michael.
I spent probably 10 or 12 years working on for or with a whole bunch of other music services, including Moog, which got acquired by Beats and became sort of the core of Apple Music. I ended up at PlayStation running their digital music service for a couple years before we sold that to Spotify. And at that point, I was really tired of basically building music subscription services, and I pivoted to work in VR, and I became the director and general manager of virtual reality platforms for PlayStation, and was accountable for launching PlayStation VR, which we did, and I worked there for a couple years. And then I left PlayStation in August of 2019. And I currently work for a company called Oso VR, which uses virtual reality to train surgeons and healthcare professionals.
Holy smokes. And I've
been working there for about a year. So I still write and record and perform regularly. I've made about an album's worth of music every year since I was 16. I play guitar not particularly well. I play synthesizer not particularly well. I'm a pretty good songwriter and a singer also.
Well, you're in good company then, because we record stuff and we don't play particularly well either.
And Anu, I've known Dee just a minute longer than I've known Anu. It's been a long time, like 25, 30 years.
That sounds about right. I think we must have met in like 1992 or 1993.
Yeah. That sounds...
So it wasn't long after Michael and I met.
Yeah, so I figured this would be great. And he's like, "Do you still know that guy?" And I'm like, "I still know that guy. I know people. I make a call. It's like the mafia." I'm like, you want to talk about audio? Yeah. So, yeah, and Anu's a mensch. He's been a longtime friend and makes great music. He's a synthesizer nerd just like you, D, and super accomplished, very, very brilliant man. And, yeah, I always call him with it. For advice as well. You guys are my two like advice guys I go to. I'm like, what do I do? How do I get my MIDI keyboard to work? So
something tells me that Anu has better advice than I have.
I mean, I always have advice. That doesn't mean any of it is good.
We've all got opinions and advice. No, we've talked about.
We've
yeah.
all got opinions. What we do share they count for?
No, he's great. Kind, generous, brilliant. You know, I'm so great, so grateful that you're here on this thing too. So D could
me too,
get
man.
So gleeful.
Me too.
D
so, I would like to start by telling a story that I didn't want to talk to Anu about until we press record, because I still remember. I never actually got to meet Anu, I don't think, when you worked at AID, Anu.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, but so it was around, it was probably what, Michael? It was sometime in 92, I think. Michael?
Yeah, I think early 90s.
It would have been probably early 92. I was singing in a band and we had gotten a deal and we were recording our first record and Michael was helping with it. Michael co-produced, engineered, did the bulk of the mixing, all that stuff. And when we mixed it, we camped out at AID over a couple of weekends and used that demo room to mix. Yeah. So I was at the time I was hanging out at the promotional offices for the label I was on, which was was in the Taft building at Hollywood and Taft. So I was always generally pretty, you know, within spitting distance of AID. So I would go over there sometimes because Michael, you know, we were poor. Me and the rest of the guys in the band were all very poor. We didn't have access to a DAT player. Michael was the only one that we knew that had access to a DAT player. So anytime we needed to like dub a DAT or get a, you know, dub a cassette from a DAT, or mixed down to a DAT, I would run over there and go, "Hey, can you know?" Or I'd call them and say, "Hey, can you make a copy of this for me?" And I would sometimes drop in there and pick it up. And one time I went into AID during the day, and Michael was there, and he goes, "You see that guy back there?" And I was like, "Yeah." I could just see some guy sitting in the back in a back room that was like cordoned off with some windows, and it just looked like a laboratory. There was like all kinds of junk on the shelves and stuff, and you had your head down, and he goes, "That guy just invented this thing called the spatializer. I was like, what's that? He goes, he figured out a way to make 3D audio work through stereo speakers. I was like, holy shit, for real? And he goes, yeah. He was like, he goes, if you want, I think we were in the middle of mixing, or we were about to, or maybe we had done that first weekend. And I was like, oh, I want to hear it. I want to hear what it does. He goes, and Michael said that it was in the demo room, that there was a version of it set up in the demo room, and that we could dink around with it. So Michael and I got to talking, and we were trying to find an excuse to use it on this album we were working on. And there's a song that I think was like the second song on the album that we were working on that opened up with this feedback with a real long bit of feedback. And we figured out that we could do something crazy, something spatializer-y with that. And I'll never forget it. The rest of the guys came in and we were already starting to play with it. And Andy, the guitar player, was like, well, what are you guys doing? And we were both sitting there huddled over Anu's joystick, like moving it around, you know, like doing this thing. And we're like, get out of here. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. It's going to be cool.
Leave me alone.
Yeah. Leave us alone. It's going to be fine. And he was like, what are you doing? I go, don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. Michael might have played with it before that, but that was like my first exposure to your spatializer. And we got it to do some really cool stuff, but unfortunately, we neither one of us were very smart at the time. We also had this grand idea of like crossfading like the first three tracks together. And in the process of doing that, what we did sounded great when it was by itself, but then it kind of got lost as a result of the crossfade, unfortunately.
Well,
but I was so excited when he described it to me, and I never got to meet you at the time.
I should jump in right away and clarify one thing, which is that I did not invent the spatializer. The spatializer was invented by a guy named Steven Desper, who was a recording engineer for the Beach Boys. And that was how I met Michael, was that, you know, when I first moved to LA, I had like a degree from an Ivy League college in economics, but I didn't want like a consulting job or a Wall Street job or something. I wanted some sort of like 9-to-5er that would pay my rent and let me have time to like rehearse and write songs with my band, because I wasn't going to be like an office person. I was going to be a rock star. And the first job I had, I ended up working at a company that was selling shares in oil wells that didn't exist, a total like boiler room operation, out of an office in Beverly Hills. Yeah. And I basically quit when the U.S. Marshals started showing up and I realized that the whole thing was a scam.
Oof.
And then sort of through a friend of a friend of a friend, I got hooked up with this company called Spatializer. And somehow ended up getting hired to do like, I don't know, marketing or something. Well, oh no, this is a great, great example of how things work when you're that age. So this friend of a friend of a friend was like, there's this company that my buddy has that has this audio technology and they need someone to do like music demonstrations for it. And I was like, sure, I'm a musician, I can make music. And they were like, great. And I ended up meeting Jim Pace at AID and Michael Hately, and they were like, okay, so you can come in and use the studio in the evenings, use the demo room in the evenings to record stuff and make this demo music for us. So I was like, okay, that's fine. And I had started doing it for a couple nights. And then after a week or two, they brought me in and they said, hey, we have a project for you. I said, all right, well, what's the project? They said, well, we're just about out of money and we have about $20,000 left. And we'd like to give you this $20,000. Can you make us a promotional video that we can use to raise more money? And I looked at them and I said, I can absolutely do that. And of course, my head, I'm thinking, I have no idea what I'm going to do. Like, what am I possibly going to do? So went out and hired an industrial film company to make this film with the last of their money, and they had this big party at the record plant for investors, and were able to raise more money, which was great. And at that point, they said, okay, well, now we'd like you to work as like a marketing guy for this company. And I had not done anything like that before. But of course, I was like, I can absolutely do that for you. And that's when I ended up working in that little back office at AID that was like upstairs. It was basically like a junk room where they
Remember that now.
Because there wasn't any other place for me to sit. And I wasn't really part of the AID staff. So I would just kind of like... hide in the back there and like work on the computer all day or go drive. Like part of my job was taking this thing around to recording studios and, you know, getting people to demo it or use it on records. It was a weird job, but I did get to go see a whole bunch of mid and top tier studios in the Los Angeles area at that time in like the early 90s. And I got to meet a few really interesting people. Probably the most notable one was at one point. So our corporate offices were up in Mountain View. And at one point I was up there for the day working and I get this message from the receptionist. She sticks her head and yells across the office, "Hey, Anu, there's an Edward Van Halen on line one for you." And I'm looking around. I'm like, "Ha ha, guys, this is very funny. All right." I pick up the phone and I'm like, "Hello, is this Edward Van Halen?" And there's this voice on the line. It's like, "Yeah, yeah, this is Ed." And I'm like, "Oh, shit.
It's real.
Actually Eddie Van Halen." And he's like, "Yeah, I hear about this spatializer thing. I got to try it." And I'm just like, I'm starting to shake. I'm like, "Oh my fucking God." And sure enough, somehow he'd gotten my number from presumably one of the other studios or whatever I demoed this thing for. And he's like, "I want to try this thing out." So literally like a couple weeks later, I'm driving out to his compound on, you know, up in one of the canyons there and dropping this stuff off. And when I dropped it off, they were basically just like, just sort of push it out the car window and get the hell out. Like didn't meet anybody or anything, but I was like, okay. Yeah. A couple of weeks later, I call them back up and they're like, yeah, we want to buy a bunch of these things. We're going to use them on Van Halen 3. And I was like, okay, well, I can get you a pretty good deal on it if you let us do like a press release or something like that. And we worked something out. They used the spatializer on Van Halen 3, and I went back to like drop off their units and pick up the demo units. And at that point, I got to meet Eddie Van Halen, and he comes rolling up in his golf cart with his cow print pajamas. And
wow.
I shook his hand and he starts talking with me and he's like, "Hey, do you play guitar?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Do you want a guitar?" And I was like, "Dude, I can't accept a guitar, like just conflict of interest." He looks at me and he goes, "Dude, come on. Do you want a guitar?" And I was like, "Yeah." So he opens his garage and he pulls out this case and he starts talking to me about how he's just made these brand new guitars with PV. He's super excited about them. They're best guitars he's ever made. And he's just puts a case like on his driveway and opens one up and he's like, "How about this one? You want this one?" And I was like, "Yeah, that looks great." He's like, "Great, here, it's yours." And he's like, "Do you want a stack?" And he pulls out a 5150 stack. I couldn't even fit the whole thing in my car. I had to leave the one of the cabinets at his place and I was too embarrassed to go back, but I still have the guitar. I ended up selling the stack. But he was one of the nicest guys I ever met. So anyway, I worked at Spatializer for a number of years. It was an interesting company. They had this technology, as Michael says, that does surround sound out of two speakers. Now, at the time, it was very, very basic, very simple analog, simple but effective analog technology, where basically you take your stereo signal and you run it into a bandpass filter centered around like 500 hertz, rotate one side out of phase, and kaboom, you get this enormous, and mix that back into your stereo signal, and you get this enormous sound. Now, towards the end of the 90s, they would start to do more advanced stuff where they hired DSP engineers and started to do it sort of properly using HRTFs and a much more sophisticated technology. But at that point, the market had started to change a bit. there were two other companies doing similar things at the time. There was one called SRS and one called Q-Sound, and they all kind of sued each other to a point where the market became toxic and nobody.
I remember SRS. Yeah.
Nobody would do business with any of them.
I kind of remember this on the periphery, and I've always, just purely based on my encounter with the Spatializer, I was hyper aware of it from that point on. Like I began to, like Michael was telling me at that day, I think even, that he was saying, yeah, Anu's, he said, this thing's going to, they're going to start licensing this thing, and it's going to be like in everything. It's going to be like in home stereos. And then sure enough, like about a year later, I started to see it popping up in marketing materials for like receivers and stuff.
Yeah, they had originally, you know, something like a 500 hertz bandpass filter with some phase rotation is a pretty simple circuit. But by that point, nobody wants to build discrete components into anything. So the big step was that we got Matsushita to make an analog chip that would do this stuff. And then it was just a matter of getting people to try to build this chip in. And it was even built into some Apple computers for a couple of years.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
But even then, getting people to add like a 5 cent integrated circuit was still really challenging, particularly for something like audio, which, as we know, a lot of people just don't care about, or for an effect that, you know, is for stereo content when you're sitting in the sweet spot. And of course, we were also at that point, you know, by now we're talking like mid-90s getting into the later part of the 90s, and things are really starting to go more digital, and companies really want a software-based solution instead of a hardware-based solution. It was just, it was a great learning experience. That was also where I learned to be a product manager. At a certain point, one of the people at Spatializer approached me and said, hey, I think you'd be a good product manager. And I said, I have no idea what that is. He said, oh, it's the best job and I'll teach you how to do it. And at that point, my real sort of professional career began, and I had this great opportunity to design hardware and software products from the ground up. I got to design a Pro Tools plugin. I got to design a rack mount hardware unit. And really, that's what set the stage. Like the connections I made there, the skills I learned as a product manager led to my later career in digital music.
Very cool. Well, I'm crushed to some degree because when I saw you back there in that room, and Michael was talking about what you were doing, I had this vision of you being this mad scientist that hold himself up in that room 24/7. You know, like you were one of those guys where people rolled in at 6 a.m. and you were still in there from the night before working on something.
I'm like, don't talk to him.
Yeah.
Now, Stephen Desper was definitely like
a
crazy mad scientist. And yeah, he'd been chasing and working on this stuff for years. I am definitely more of a I will get very into things, but as far as work goes, I'm definitely like, what is the fastest way I can get this done?
my kind of guy.
That's right. Return on investment. I need to get in and get out. Yeah. So Stephen was a trip. I remember, you know, having some interactions with Stephen Desper, and I was just like, this guy's a trip. I mean,
you met him too, Michael?
Yeah. I met him a bunch of times, you know, and they would bring the boxes in and sometimes they break. It was really interesting because it was like the rack mount box is what I remember. And then it had a cable that would go to this remote control that had 8 channels of little joysticks on it. You know, it was like about this big and that long, and it had like 8 little joysticks on it. And you can grab the joystick and spin it around, and you'd hear, depending on what the content was, the audio source, sometimes it was more effective than others. Like on that guitar thing that we did it on, that was pretty good. It kind of went around and you're just like, whoa,
what's I could that hear about? It. I remember hearing it, you know, but other in headphones.
And other things we put it on, I was like, not so much.
Yeah, it was a really finicky effect in a lot of ways. And the way that they had built the box, you know, it had basically like TT connectors on the front, or I think maybe even, I can't remember, I think they also had a grip of XLRs on the back, but it was kind of a pain in the butt to integrate. And as you note, like some stuff it would work really great on and other things not so much. And yeah. I don't know. It was And it was incredibly expensive. I believe the first box, and this was in, you know, 1990-ish dollars, but it was like $10,000 for one.
That's a lot.
Oof.
Yeah.
I remember Michael saying, like, hey, this thing's really expensive. This thing's really, really expensive. And it only made me more excited.
Yeah, and it was finicky. It would break a lot. And they had done a lot of stuff inside since the core technology was, relatively speaking, simple. They had done a lot of very convoluted things in how they designed it to try to camouflage what it was actually doing. And so, like, the first hardware product I designed, I was like, well, let's make an MI level, you know, or prosumer level box. So I made a single rack space unit that was all discrete circuitry, that was just like stereo expansion, and you could still do a lot of placement with it. You couldn't really do the front to back stuff, but that was the most subtle aspect of what that thing was doing anyway.
Yeah, it was interesting. So this is the connection from Anu to D. So it's on Eddie Van Halen's record.
And it's, yeah, on
I didn't know that. Yeah,
it got used on a bunch of things here and there. You know, Jim Pace at AID knew a ton of top tier recording engineers.
Yeah,
Ed Cherney and, you know,
Joe Ciccarelli.
Yeah, and basically if you look at those guys' discographies, if you pulled them out, I could go through and point at a bunch of records and be like, oh, it was used on this and that and the other. Like, there was a Bonnie Raitt record that came out in 1992 and it got used on that.
Wow.
So, you know, there were a few of them. I think the main problem was just like, it was expensive. You had to use it at the mixing stage. And a lot of people were just like, yeah, I don't care. It was one of the things I really learned about that, from that entire experience is that cool technology doesn't matter. There would be a lot of people that would see or hear demos of this thing and they'd be like, well, it's really cool, but so what?
Yeah.
It's interesting you say that, because that's, you know, like you, in the late 90s, I had young kids and I had to figure out what I was going to do when I grew up and got into software engineering. And eventually found my way into iOS development. And as I'm sure you know, Anu, in Apple land, they're constantly rolling out shiny new things every year, WWDC, and everybody gets excited about them. And it's a constant recurring theme of, you know, as a software engineer working for a big company, like going, hey, Apple just came up with this really cool thing. We should find a way to use it. And it's some amount of that every year. It's like, yeah, I don't know. it's me going back to our product managers and then just going, I don't know. Can you just go back to working on this grunt thing?
Yeah, it's funny. As I have continued in my career as a product manager, you know, I have one persona that I adopt or a philosophy I espouse sometimes of the lazy product manager, which is, you know, people come up to me and they're like, hey, we need to build this new feature, this new thing. And I'm like, I don't think you do. First of all, it sounds like work. And they're like, no, we really got to do it. It's going to be really cool. I'm like, nope, it's work. And we've already got plenty of stuff to do. Number one. Number two, like, we're just going to screw it up. We're just going to write more bugs.
Well,
it's going to be more work for us to do. And it's going to make the product more complicated. And then we got to train people. It's like,
time. And yeah. I'm not going to make money.
And the idea behind this ultimately is that you have to start really setting a high bar for adding new stuff because of all of the extra things that come in. It just like you guys were talking a couple of episodes back about like plugins and tools. And that's how I feel about those these days as well. It's like there's a cost for new gear, and it's not just what you pay for it. It's the time investment you have to make to like learn and master the thing and learn how to use it in a tasteful way and integrate it into your workflow. And the more that I work on stuff or the older I get, the more I'm like, I don't want extra stuff because it's just more burden, you know, even if, unless it's going to dramatically improve capabilities.
That is a very, very good analogy for that.
Quality versus quantity, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I guess in a sense, at the micro level, that's really what we're doing when we're producing music, right? Is we end up becoming our own product managers in a way when it comes to that kind of stuff. and as a product manager trying to finish a record, you're constantly struggling with wondering if the shiny new thing is going to make things better, or if it's going to take longer, or if it's going to be something you spend, you know, a couple days, a week playing with, and then just give up on that, you know, just deciding that it's not really going to be the thing that you want to do. And is it really worth it?
Yeah. And is there room to swing the cat on this stuff too? You know, like you've got the practical
swing
side.
Swing the cat.
Yeah. It's an old expression. Just give me a little room to swing a cat.
Yeah.
It's terrible. Because I don't eat cat anymore at all. They're sweet creatures. I love them. All of them. But before that, it's like, where you got to let your muse out. You got to let your creative nature out. You know, like, I guess you'd call it R&D is a way, you know, like, can I experiment with a bunch of junk? And how much time am I going to give myself? And like, when is this thing due? Like, do I have accountability is a huge issue for most musicians. I know people, you know, that still haven't finished the record they started 25 years ago. I know a bunch of those guys, me included, where I'm just like, I'm going to do that EP someday soon. I know exactly what I'm going to do. And then the next day I'm like, oh, I'm a fucking loser. I don't sound like the people I, you know, think I want to. And it's like, you know, so it is this is the madness part of the podcast, which is like, you know, how effective are we being? But we don't want to be all, you know, checking boxes and stuff. There is that, because every producer I know typically has a whiteboard on the wall with all the instruments that they think they're going to like apply to this thing, because you kind of have a template of some sort, I think. And then you start checking boxes off as you go, like, oh, for all these songs is the second rhythm guitar done, and they're all checked off, and it's like, great, it all sounds awesome. And then you kind of move through all that stuff so you can keep track of it without going nuts and did I lose something. But also like, oh, hey, so-and-so just got a new, you know, gizmo instrument that hasn't been used before, and it's kind of new to us. Do we want to take a little time and experiment with it, you know? And, you know, how much time am I going to give that? And, you know, I don't know that there's any sort of solid answer for it, but I know, like, I go from, like, right brain, left brain, it ping-pongs back and forth to, you know, to reasonable effect. But also, you know, sometimes it drives me nuts where I'm just like, I get bogged down in the minutiae of it. And I just want to have fun. I want to make noise, let someone else press record and stop record. But since most of the people that I know are, you know, sort of like bedroom producers, which is most of the biggest records out there are like that. And then they get finished in a proper studio or not, you know, like look at like Billie Eilish, like that whole thing, you know. There's probably some finishing done in the studio, but you know, a lot of that stuff you can do in your bedroom, which I think is incredible.
They even said, I think Phineas said when he was getting interviewed after they both won a buttload of Emmys.
Yeah.
Grammys. Yeah. That they had it mastered by a dude in his bedroom. It was just some well-known mastering dude. They just, you know, they went over to his house and he mastered everything. And that was that.
Well, if I can jump in here, there's definitely some thoughts I have about that. So one of the things I like about this podcast is that it seems like you guys are talking about a lot of different things in terms of how they can relate to being a creative person or a creative adult, and perhaps potentially even, if I want to narrow the scope a little bit more, an amateur as opposed to a professional, right? How do you continue to be a good creative person as a working adult? And one of the things I would note is that this inability to finish, or this lack of a deadline or pressure to finish, is one of the things that I think really hampers a lot of musicians, particularly with home recording. You know, in the old days, it was like, well, I have a budget and I'm going into the studio and I've got to get it done before the money and time runs out. You get to your home studio now, you get set up, and you're like, well, this is great. Like, I don't have any deadlines. And then the problem is just that you never finish anything.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I believe is that we get better at what we do more of, right? So if you practice finishing songs, you get better at finishing songs. And one of the things that was a really transformative event in my life was doing something called the RPM challenge. And this was a thing where you go to a website and you sign up to write and record an album starting with nothing in the month of February. And I did it for like 4 or 5 years in a row. And I learned more about songwriting and being an artist and making records in the, you know, 5 months that I did that than I had in really like the previous 10 years. And while it is true that there is value in being able to chip away at something for months or even years, I would argue for most of us, the idea that like, I'm going to get in here and I'm going to make 10 songs or 35 minutes of music within a 28-day time frame and make it as good as I can make it, but make decisions, creative decisions or otherwise, stick to them and move on and finish doing that over and over and over again. I learned so much about my workflow, about my ideas, about separating the creative person from the judging person. You know, cause like the creative person is all very improv-y and like, yes, and like, this is a good idea and let's run with it. Right. And let's add stuff. And the judging is all like, nope, this is bad. Like reject it. You have to keep those things far apart. So anyway, that was a really great thing in this notion of home studios. I think the main thing that there's nothing wrong with just like playing around with stuff and making noise and having a good time. But I think if what you want to do is actually finish stuff, you have to develop a discipline or a practice of actually finishing things and letting them go.
Oh, I agree, man. 110%. That's always been my thing is being more about the practice of finishing something, maybe sometimes to a fault, but that's always been my thing too.
Yeah. Like write, record, finish, and publish. Like that became my mantra for this year, and I'm sucking at it super hard. But this is how it
you'll
used
get there
to be. In the old days when you've got, you know, recording studios and you're like, oh, I got this band, we got these three songs, and my buddy's got a studio, we got it for 2 days, you know, or we've only got this much money, we just got a little bit of money from our manager or for some from so and so, and how much can we get done, you know, we really, but it's like we got to get these three songs done, you know, as much as we possibly can. And then the rush is on, you know, because you got an engineer who's going to get paid, but like he needs you to get the fuck out of there because he's got whatever's next for him coming in. And there was something really urgent about that. And in that urgency, I find, you know, when you have a deadline, just like you said, Anu, there's an urgency in it. There's a whole level of creativity that comes out of that for me, where it's like, you just become a decision maker at that point and you just can't screw around anymore. And there's time for screwing around ahead of time. Maybe I get a frame around sort of what I want to do. Like you pick however many songs, and that process is really great. I've watched you go through that and you're like, it's amazing. And I'm like, wait a minute, you just did another record? You know, like Anu is constantly making records. D is constantly making records. You know what I mean?
It's true.
And I'm working my way back into that world. And, you know, and it's interesting because like, as the mastering engineer, when I put that hat on, I'm the guy who finishes shit. And I'm the guy who says, you know, this is done from my point of view. Are you guys happy with it? You know what I mean? And then from there, it's the hot seat job. Because, you know, when I was working at Warner Brothers, it's like you'd send it off to manufacturing and they'd make 100,000 copies of whatever it was. So it better be finished, you know? And, you know, there's a process for fixing shit there too. But like, that's a whole nother story. But really, like, how do you, you know, if you want to bring some urgency to whatever you're creating, like give yourself a deadline.
Like the RPM challenge.
Yeah. But also create, you got to have accountability for that. Cause if I'm the only one accountable for my own shit, yeah, maybe it gets done. Maybe it won't. But if I'm working with someone who's doing the same thing with me, you know, or you're doing the RPM challenge, you know, something like that, where you're like, oh, it has to get done, you know, if we want to get this out and like part of this whole process, then it gets done. Cause I find without accountability from another human being on my part, it's probably not going to happen.
You know? Well, there's some self-discipline involved too. And it's another one of those things that, just like I was saying, if you're able to practice being disciplined or making yourself stick to your deadlines or your goals, you get better at doing that too.
Absolutely. It's like anything, you know, going to the gym, playing your guitar.
It is.
It really is.
It's true. It's very true.
And this is part of why I like this concept of referring to it as a practice. I don't just mean practice in the sense of like, oh, I'm practicing my guitar and I'm getting better at it. I mean a practice in the sense of like something that you do every day as a matter of course, right? And both as a creative person or an artist and as a person, I think it's good for us to cultivate those things.
Yeah, and the meditation part of the podcast too, the mindfulness part, is really just, you know, you practice it because you practice it and it has some results for you, but you'll discover those along the way. It's not like I say, if you meditate for the next 10 days, you're going to win $1,000 somewhere. You're going to have a whole lot of people meditating out there, but for a different reason, because after that, they're going to probably stop and go, crap, I didn't win $1,000. I missed a day. It's like, why are you doing these things? Well, you do it because you're doing it, because you want to practice it. And you have some effects to these things. Even finishing music, for that matter, is like, does anybody really care? You know, if there's not a record label waiting there for like a product or something, you know, or whatever that is. I really like that idea of just, you know, chop wood, carry water. We just do it because
at the end of the day, you have to care.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only person that really needs to care is you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the things that potentially musicians, again, struggle with is like, I think music is supposed to have an audience. People are supposed to listen to it. It's like half of the loop. But particularly these days, nobody's listening. So why do you do it? Mm-hmm. And there are days I ask myself that all the time. Like, why am I making these dumb little songs or these records? And some of it is because, well, I like doing it, or it's who I am. And you never know when someone's going to connect with it. Just a couple weeks ago, I got an email from Bandcamp that told me that somebody in Australia had bought every single album I had all at once. And I was like,
nice.
What? Yeah. And
that's awesome.
I emailed the person and I just said, you know, you made my year. And like, how did you hear about me? All the rest. And he was just like, yeah, I love your stuff. And, you know, okay, great. Like, that'll keep me going for another 12 months.
Oh, yeah. That'd keep me going for a decade. Easy.
Have you guys seen the Zappa documentary?
I have.
Yes. And I loved what he described. You know, they're like, why are you over here making this record in England, you know, with all these strings? And he said, because I want to take this home and listen to the thing that I created and see if I got as close as I can to the initial spark of creativity for that particular song. And that's it. He said, if anyone else likes it, that's great. I may release it. But he said, mostly it's for my own edification. And I'm just like, wow,
yeah.
That's just total self-sufficiency. He's, and like enjoying his creative process. And yeah, what a fascinating dude that guy was.
Him and Scott Walker. Like those two people are big inspirations for me.
Oh, I love Scott Walker.
It's just the
best. Love Scott Walker.
Just the best.
Yeah. And you know, in a similar fashion, like one of the reasons, like, of course I would love it if everybody listened to my stuff and thought it was awesome, but I'm also aware enough as an artist, and I'm sure you guys are too. Like, I know that I'm not going to be Billie Eilish. You know, I've known that since like the mid 90s, like the stuff I make is a little idiosyncratic and a little dark and maybe also not good.
But, come on now.
But I make it anyway, because some of it is a little bit like running a marathon or something where it's like, I enjoy the challenge. But I also just, there is nothing in my life that makes me feel as good as hearing that first mix of something when I'm pushing all the faders up with all the different parts.
Same.
And it's just like, oh yeah.
Same. But there's no, for me, there's no, the only thing that comes close to the feeling of satisfaction of getting down to mixing down an album or listening to the whole thing complete is finishing a big feature in a piece of software or finishing a piece of software. Just a feeling of accomplishment is, there's nothing like it for me. It's just nothing like it.
So are we just a bunch of accomplishment junkies? Is that what's going on here?
I definitely am. Sounds like Anu is too.
You know, I was, I came from a very high pressure school environment. I was part of various like gifted and talented programs and was one of those kids who was identified as being smart at a very early age and put under a lot of pressure as a result. And one of the things I have struggled with as I've gotten older is this notion of like focusing on the finish line rather than the race. I'm sure that part of what drives me is this notion of like finishing things or making achievements. But particularly over the last, I don't know, 10 years, I've been doing a lot of work to try to get away from that and focus more on enjoying the process of doing it and being less concerned about the outcome. Like when I think about how painters work, right? My somewhat naive perspective is that most painters paint because they like to paint. They like the creative process, and the canvases that result are like banana peels, right?
Sure.
It's just like the byproduct.
Yep.
And you know, they're all stacked up in the corner of their studio, and it's someone else who comes through and picks through them and is like, this one's good, this one's good, no, 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 this one's pretty good, no, no, no. You know, I'm trying to get to a place with my own creative pursuits that is more with that, where it's like, even if you talk to big stars, like they seldom know which one of their songs are going to be big hits.
Yeah.
You know, they have a pile of songs and they're like, I don't know, but these are all pretty good, I think. And yet someone, the public, an A&R guy, listens to them is like, nope, this one here is the hit. Like, I have no idea. And rather than chasing that hit like I was doing when I was in my 20s, I'm just like, I'm just going to do it because I like doing it, and I'll have this pile of stuff that results and someone else can pick through
you're
it
just,
and tell me.
You're just an artist throwing banana peels back into the corner, waiting for someone to pick through them. Yeah, that's a really good, that's a good analogy too. I very much feel the same way about it.
Yeah, I just watched this interview with this publisher woman, and she was really amazing and but also kind of dark. She was really kind of, you know, like, here's how it used to be, here's how it is now. And she's about our age, you know, about 22, right? 22. Anyway, so she's was doing her thing and talking about the process of publishing, and she has artists that she represents and catalogs that she represents, and really trying to pick out, you know, which is the hit, you know what I mean? Like, so that was her job, is to figure out, you know, thank God it's not our job. You know, they'll pick it out and go, oh, that's the one. And then she has to go sell it because that's her job. She has to go out and like, you know, make shekels with that, you know, like get it into things and like do co-writes with other people and like get those people out there to do that stuff. So she was really the champion for those folks. And having the hard talks with people too, going like, yeah, this is all, none of this is going to work for what we're at, what we need. Or if a label needs, they have a new artist and they just don't, they've got everything done except for the single. Like they just don't have the single yet. Then they bring in a bunch of writers. And so that's her job, is to kind of like, you know, get that stuff going. And I'm like, thank God I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Cause I know what I like. I mean, I listen to so much music and I know what I like and I know what I love. But it has nothing to do with hits. I mean, and I hear hits and I'm like, that's pretty damn good, you know? But I don't think I'd be a good A&R person or a publisher, you know, because I wouldn't be able to tell you like which one's the money one, which is the money song. I might go, well, that's like, there's a song I heard by this band called, I think they're called Wet Leg, and they're from the Isle of Man. And it's called this, oh, what's the name of that song? She's Long. She's Long is the name of this song, and it's so fucking great. And I'm like, that just came from out of nowhere. And it's just, and every time I hear it, I just fucking stop and I turn the radio up. And I haven't done that in a long ass time. And it's just this like indie rock, you know, super high energy thing. And I'm like, that's a fucking hit right there. Cause I can feel it. Like I'm compelled to like turn it up. And, but I couldn't tell you other than that, you know, like if I'd have seen them in a club and gone like, whoa, that song, you know,
banger.
Yeah, it's really great. But you know, is that going to translate into money for them? I have no idea. I know they're getting some traction, but like that whole level of the business is a whole other thing, you know?
I feel like when I was a kid coming up playing in punk rock bands and hearing about, you know, the artists who says, oh, screw the record label, man. Like they don't understand me. They don't this and that. Like I could empathize with that until we got a deal. The deal that we got, through the deal that we got, I got to be really close with the guy who was the marketing guy. And he gave me so much insight into the business that I feel like I began to be the person in the room that had the unpopular opinion of, well, what they do is really hard.
Yeah.
You know, like that's not, you know, when I hear people say that, it's like, well, I don't think that's entirely fair. Because, you know, sometimes it's legitimate. Sometimes, you know, they're dealing with somebody that genuinely just doesn't have an ear for it, or just, you know, just doesn't have good notes. But I would say most of the time that, you know, people are, you know, people in those positions, like your friend, are genuinely good at their job and they have a good ear. And if they don't hear something, they don't hear something, you know?
Well, yeah. And ultimately what all these people are trying to do is to get, they see something in the artists that they're working with of like, this could appeal to a lot of people. And sometimes it's just as is, and it just needs to get out there. But most of the time, it's like working with a producer or anybody. They're saying, okay, you're really close, but I think if you just nudge it this way, or if you do it this way, or if you put another chorus in here, or do a better vocal take, you know, it will suddenly appeal to an order of magnitude more folks. And you have to get to a place as an artist where you're less precious about your stuff or willing to make those kinds of accommodations. Now, it's another thing entirely if they're like, oh, you know, I think you should replace all the guitars with saxophones or something like that. Like, there are those types of things that happen, but I have a hard time believing that bands that are in that kind of situation didn't know that that's what they were getting into in the first place.
Sure.
And yes, there's a handful of horror stories, but like you, most of the time it's just people being divas. And from my perspective, particularly where I'm at now, the attitude I try to cultivate is always, well, let's try it and see what happens. You know, like what's the worst thing that happens? Well, we'll give it a shot. And if doesn't work out, we'll try something else.
Run away and try something else.
And yeah.
It's a big deal.
So you were talking about spatial audio. I think this
Anu. So bringing it all the way back around to spatial audio. So you were saying that, here's, you were talking about the fact that it was a bit of a struggle, you know, selling this new technology to studios and pitching studios on the idea of mixing with this thing. You know, for me, I like when at the time Michael told me about it, it was describing me what it is. I grew up playing in punk rock bands, and the one thing that has resonated with me throughout my life, ever since the first hardcore band I played in, was one of the biggest takeaways from being involved in that scene was seeing the future. You know what I mean? Like it was clear to me very early on, from the time I started getting harassed by cops, by the time, you know, after the first show I went to, or riot cops were showing up, I wasn't scared. What I began to realize was like, oh, this is resonating with people. Like something's going on. It was the first time in my life where I felt like something is going on here. And this is not a fad. This is real. Like something is really happening that is upsetting the status quo. It's a disruptive technology. You know what I mean? And, so by the time Michael had told me about the spatializer, I've ever since that experience of playing in punk rock bands and being in that scene, in spite of all the plugins and all the discussion we've had about plugins, there's always something that you hear about and go, oh, that's going to be something. And I remember feeling that when he described it to me, because I think at the time, you tell me, Anu, but it seems like video games were just kind of beginning to noodle with like 3D audio. I remember hearing about it. So I knew it was like it was like a thing that people were experimenting with. And then once, so by the time Michael told me about it, I was like, oh shit. Like that was it. This just the purely based on his description of, was like, this is going to be fucking disruptive. This is a disruptive thing. So going back to what you were saying, one of the things that comes with a disruptive technology is the struggle to make people understand that this is the future. And it seems like you got to experience some of that and went through some of that and came out the other side. And, you know, now you are who you are.
Oh yeah. You know, I look at history a lot because there's not really anything new under the sun, particularly as far as humans and technology goes. And I put together and taught a course on the history of 20th century music about 20 years ago. And that involved a lot of looking at the 20th century and seeing how art and technology were combined. And so if you look at something like spatial audio, big surprise, like you can look back all the way back to the beginning of sound recording and see echoes of where we're at. So, you know, the first big spatial thing that happened was like in the 70s, people were trying to get quad to happen.
Right.
It's like, what's better than stereo, which gives you this immersive sound field? Well, we'll make it truly immersive and we'll put speakers behind you. And we can talk about some of the reasons that that didn't work. But the 90s come along, you start seeing this kind of stereo expansion. And this is tied to maybe the very beginnings of people starting to have home theaters, right? Really rich people are having home theaters. But spatial audio didn't take off in the 90s for a couple reasons. Some was the lawsuits that were going on. Some was just the simply like the so what factor. And another aspect was that at that time, when, you know, mid 90s, people were still buying CDs. People were still using Walkmans or Discmans or mini disc players. And basically their listening modality was equally split between like speakers and headphones. And the nature of how spatial audio works means that you can either have your spatial audio work on speakers or you can have it work on headphones, right? And for our listeners, just so that you understand, like the difference is pretty simple. If you're listening on speakers, both ears hear both speakers, right? And if you're listening on headphones, your left ear is only hearing the left speaker and your right ear is only hearing the right speaker. And that difference is why you can basically make the illusion work for one or the other. So, you know, at this time in the 90s, when people were working on the stereo expansion stuff, very beginnings of things, video games are just starting to have 16-bit sound and real sophisticated sound because there's plug-in cards for computers. But basically, the technology wasn't quite there, the content wasn't quite there, and the impact for the listener or the audience was not worth all the hassle that you had to put up with. And basically that whole spatial thing just kind of petered out. Well, here we are again. It's 2021 and a whole bunch of things have changed. And lo and behold, spatial audio is back in the news because primarily Apple has come out and said, okay, we're going to support Dolby Atmos in all of our products, right? It's getting built into the iPhones and music playback, and Apple Music is now starting to support some limited amount of spatial audio playback when they can find the content. So this discussion is coming right back up again, and everyone's like, is it really going to work this time? And my answer would be maybe, but probably not.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And
well, that's the $64,000 question.
Yeah. So a couple things have changed that make it more likely than it's ever been. So one thing is that now that everybody's listening device is software based, rather than having to throw all your hardware away and buy new hardware, you just have to get a software update and it should work. Like this is the thing that was a huge deal back in like the 70s or even the 90s. If you wanted to listen in quad, you had to go like throw out your turntable and go get a new turntable. And you had to throw out your receiver and get a new receiver because you had to have stuff that was quad capable. And even with like home theater, you got to go get like a home theater set up and put speakers and stuff behind you. Well, with software-based playback devices like smartphones and tablets or your computer, you get a software update and now it's enabled. So you don't have to make that change. That's one thing. Another thing that's changed is that people have really moved away from speakers as the primary modality for listening, and everybody's listening on headphones now. So all of a sudden, you can assume that people have access to headphones and that for people who are listening to music, this is where the majority of them are doing their serious listening. If people are listening out of speakers, they're either doing that god-awful thing where they're like holding their phone up and listening to that crummy little phone speaker, or they have like some like portable monophonic thing that they're lugging around, you know, and so they don't have hi-fi expectations out of most speaker playback situations, right? So you got software updates, you got headphones, and you have technologies now where there's enough processing power that you can do object-based audio and things like that. So everything would seem to be right. What's missing? Well, what's missing is the content. And one of the huge challenges with creating this stuff is like you can't just remaster an existing two-track mix for spatial audio, because it's just left and right. Like, you can make it wide, but you can't get any of the real height or real depth to it. So if you want to make content for spatial audio, you actually have to go back to the multi-track and do a new mix. And as you guys know, and perhaps our listeners know, that is, as we say in the biz, non-trivial.
No.
And this is happening precisely at a time where people don't really care about music that much, and label budgets are super low. So I've been talking to a couple of producer friends of mine. I won't drop any names here, but I'll tell you guys offline, who are interested in doing this stuff. And they're telling me that like budgets for doing a spatial mix of an entire album are in like the single digit thousands, which is crazy. It seems like ridiculously cheap to get some of these folks to do a remix of an entire album for like, you know, $8,000 or something. And you start thinking about, well, what am I going to do anyway? If you're taking even something like, I don't know, a Pink Floyd record, like what are you going to put over people's heads, or how are you going to do that mix in a way where it's worth listening?
Where it's going to be compelling for.
Yeah. Where it's going to be compelling. And even then, I also think that there is a market problem, which is that like the casual listener doesn't care about this stuff at all, right? Typical person who wants to sing along with the song or just like listens to music because they like it, they will not care if something is a spatial audio mix. And then if you look at the other end of the spectrum.
You're bumming me out, bro.
I'm sorry.
Bumming me out.
If you look at the other end of the spectrum at audiophiles freaking hate anything that is mucking with the sound, right? Like they just want, tube amp and a turntable and a two-track mix or even mono coming at them. So they will turn their noses up at any of this spatial audio nonsense. So there's this question of like, well, who is it for anyway? And then you could also ask, as musicians or artists, we could ask ourselves, well, on the one hand, because I'm a technically interested guy, like I'm curious as to what I could do with something like that, but is it really going to make my records better? Is it going to provide more emotional impact, or is it just kind of cool? And I find myself falling into it's kind of cool category. And so I put all these factors together, and I think what's likely to happen is that there will be a couple years where the labels will take a handful of records, they'll spend a little bit of money to get these spatial mixes, they'll put them up on Tidal and Spotify and Apple and all these different services that are supporting this now. And what they'll find is that it produces no additional engagement, no additional listens. They won't recoup any of the money. And it will be one of these things where it was like, well, there's a couple years we were trying this and then it just sort of fades out and nobody's really doing it. That is my unfortunately somewhat dark take.
Oh, you're killing me. Killing me on it.
Well, give me, I remember when they were doing trying to really make a push for DVD audio when I was at Warner Brothers, and just like that whole format. And I actually have a DVD audio player that also, plays CDs as well. And I listened to some of the stuff they did. Like they did the Flaming Lips, the Yoshimi record was, I think, who remixed it? It was a huge producer guy.
I'm remembering this now. Flaming Lips did it. There was somebody.
Yeah. And it was,
I have a Steely Dan.
Oh, that's right, Bjork.
Surround one. I have a Queensryche record. I have a Tomita record. I've got a pile of these things because obviously I'm interested in this stuff. And yeah. Who doesn't want to hear some of these really intricate records kind of mixed or spread out in a more immersive yeah. way?
And Bjork, you know, Bjork had a bunch of them, and I had a whole like series.
Like
of them.
They did a mix like that of a Radiohead album or something like that too. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, and it was just, and it was really cool. But I'm like, can I listen to this in my car? Like, I'm going through trying to, you know, get to CVS to get some like Advil or something. And like, am I going to have time to listen to my surround sound in my car, which isn't set up for it? There's no DVD audio in there. It's like, you know, it's really like a higher net worth experience, you know, for people that can afford the player and afford the hardware, like you were saying earlier, Anu, you know. And it's just like, you know, it's like the rich white guy audio is what it comes down to. It's like, you know,
yeah,
you know, and like,
and the fucked up thing is those guys are all like, well, I just want to hear, you know, a vinyl record,
yeah,
you know, through my tube preamp and my $10,000 speakers, and anything else that gets in the way, like I don't want it.
Well,
who is this for?
I don't get that. So many, many, many thoughts based on what you just said. Many thoughts. I'm crushed because when I first started hearing when I first started seeing the spatial audio campaigns that Apple was doing, I got really excited. I was like, hey, is that thing that Anu you told me about? You know, it's like Spatializer coming back. It's like this is going to be cool. And then I went to Michael and I said, I'd like to do something like that with the Nihilism Was Real album, this album that Michael helped me with, and try to remix it for spatial. And I thought that I'd be able to do something with the two track mixes. So you, I can't do that. So thank you for that.
Well, what you could do, I mean, if you think about it conceptually, what you could do is you could take that two track mix and you could kind of pull it around you, right? So that it is bigger. Like the one thing that spatial audio is great for, even if you just take a two track mix, is when you listen on headphones, the stereo field is like inside your head, right?
Yeah.
And the simplest thing that you can do with a two-track mix, which you don't even have to do any work on, is get it outside of your head so that it sounds like it's coming out of speakers in front of you. And then once you have that, you can move those speakers or stretch them around or make it sound really big.
Okay.
But it's going to be a little smeary. And it's one of those things of like...
A little phasey.
The trade-off is that things that are... meant to be punchy and in the middle may not necessarily be punchy and in the
yes.
middle.
Yes, and you mixed it intending for it to be heard in a certain context, and now it is in some ways conceptually no different than if you were like, hey, there's this new feature on all these stereos where you can crank the bass way up or add like a ton of sub bass to it using like a sub octave synthesizer, and it's like, well, it makes it all rumbly, but then you listen to your carefully mixed two track and you're like, eh, there's too much bass on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So the other thing is that what you were saying about the way people consume it, you know, I was thinking about the Apple campaign, and the Apple marketing campaign is beginning. I mean, I already kind of understood it, only because I just remember when we were playing with the Spatializer, I even remember Michael saying, you know, this is really like more of a thing for headphones. It's interesting. It was interesting to me because I picked up on this straight away that Apple's whole marketing campaign is, hey, this is going to make things in your headphones and your earbuds sound really cool. Like the commercials are even like, you know, someone putting their AirPods in and doing that. The only thing that the best thing I could figure is that just thinking about Apple's motivation is that I know that they're working on some firmware updates to the AirPod Pros, and I keep hearing a lot of buzz like amongst the Mac blogs, the Apple blogs, that there's new AirPod Pros coming out. So there could be some kind of marketing confluence that's going to happen there. Like, you know, because they know they're coming out with new AirPod Pros and they're getting in front of it by using spatial audio as a thing.
Yeah. And what's the incentive? I mean, you know, that's the thing, you know, like, you know, Steve Jobs came up with the problem to solve, which is like, how do you get 1,000 songs in your pocket? We didn't have that problem before until he said, you need 1,000 songs in your pocket. How are you going to do it? He said, I have the answer. And he's got an iPod. And it did change everything in a way. But the only reason he put iTunes together was to sell iPods. You know,
that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I know right. a ton about this stuff because I worked on all of this in the early days. And yeah. for one thing, like much as Apple loves to rewrite history, the iPod was far from the first MP3 player.
That's right.
And it wasn't even the first hard disk based MP3 player.
No, it wasn't.
Yes. There were a bunch of products that had come out in the years before. Now, they were admittedly pretty janky in a lot of ways. But it was clear to me when I first discovered MP3s in 97 or 98 that it was going to change the music world dramatically. And that was where the initial seed of the idea that turned into Rhapsody and the music subscription service came from. When you start looking at the impact that the iPod and things like that had on people's ability to listen, the portability was a huge deal. And you were talking about iTunes. The whole reason they actually started the iTunes store was because there were congressional hearings because companies like Disney were saying publicly that Apple was enabling people to pirate content. There was a big campaign that Hollywood started, yeah. and it was guys at Disney. It was Mike Eisner at Disney, among other people, that had said, I can dig up the headlines, but it was like, Apple is enabling people to engage in piracy using the new iMac. They had Apple had a whole rip, mix, burn ad campaign.
Yeah, I remember that. I do.
And basically, Disney was like, this is unconscionable that Steve Jobs is actually getting out there and telling people to steal our content, to rip, mix, and burn it. Using these new iMacs. And this was going to torpedo the ability for them to sell these iPods and get them out the door. So right. Steve Jobs came up with this idea of like, all right, fine, well, we'll have a store where people can buy legitimate content so that we have this fig leaf that it's like not about this piracy, but it's about buying protected stuff. And he went around to all the different record companies. And at the time, Apple had like no market share. It's hard to remember, but this is in like,
that's true.
And this was at the period of time where like Dell was ascendant and Michael Dell was basically saying that Apple should shut the company down and give the money back to the investors. And so Steve Jobs was able to go to all these record executives and say, hey, look, I built that computer that you're using on your desk. Just let me and my little tiny company sell songs for a buck and we'll make you guys a ton of money. And this was particularly revolutionary because the illegal version of Napster had already been operating for a couple of years. And Napster was getting sued. And at that point, Napster had been represented by a venture capital firm that had gone to the record labels and said, look, we will give you guys $1 billion if you let us sell these songs for a buck. And the record companies were like, there is no way we're ever going to let anyone sell songs, unprotected songs, for a buck. It's never going to happen. Never going to happen. Steve Jobs goes in there. I don't know what he did with these guys, but he walks out with special sweetheart deals where Apple was allowed to sell songs for a buck. And that launched the iTunes store. And then a couple years later, they removed copy protection. And because Apple had such a head start and such sweetheart deals that nobody else could get, I know because I tried.
Yeah.
Basically, the record companies screwed themselves and made Apple the gatekeeper for the download market. It was also clear to me, though, based on looking at these MP3 players, that no average person wanted to deal with downloads. I remember I had a very early MP3 player, the Diamond Rio, and I was on an airplane.
I remember that.
And one of the flight attendants came up to me and said, hey, what is that thing that you're listening to? And I said, oh, well, this is the future of how we're all going to listen to music. And they picked it up and they're like, oh, it's so light. You know, like, how does it work? And I started to explain to them that, like, well, you know, in order to get music on this thing, you have to take your CD and you have a computer program that rips the file off the CD. And then you take the file and you transfer it over a cable. And like halfway through this description, I could just see.
Just glazed.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, what? It's clear to me that as revolutionary as these downloads are, the average user is not going to want to deal with any of this stuff. And so even when the iPod took off and everyone was talking about download stores and this, that, and the other, I was already going, That is, as one of my colleagues, Tim Quirk, the singer from Too Much Joy, who I worked with for many years, he said, iTunes is yesterday disguised as tomorrow. And I think that that summed it up really nicely. We knew very early on that the future was beyond files and that it was all about streaming. But yeah, lot of stuff to talk about in there. Now, that said, if anyone can make spatial audio work for the masses, it's going to be Apple.
So Anu, there's a question I've been thinking about that we didn't ask up front. What is spatial audio? What sparked Stephen Desper to become interested in it? And if this isn't the thing that's going to that plies some improvement of the experience, some new thing that it comes closer to replacing the experience of having an album and perusing the album while you're listening to a record, then what do you think it is?
All right. So spatial audio, strictly speaking, I think in the current vernacular, spatial audio refers to the ability to take a sound source and place it anywhere in virtual 3D space when you are listening, right? So we don't really think about this too much, but the way that our ears work, you can close your eyes and pretty much point to where a sound is coming from, whether it is above you, below you, behind you, to the left of you, to the right of you. If you hear a sound, you can just close your eyes and point right at it instantaneously. When we think about how music is traditionally made, it's coming out of speakers, which are point sources. And that means that they're in front of you for the most part. And Jim Pace was the one who described it best. He's like, you want to understand spatial audio? He's like, you know how when you're listening to two speakers and sound sounds like it's coming from in between them, even though there's no speaker there? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, that's what spatial audio is. Okay, it's an illusion that a sound is coming from a particular place. You can experience that. Yeah, you can experience that with stereo, with the idea that, like, even if you have your speakers to the left and right of you, you hear sound coming from the middle. Spatial audio just takes that and says, okay, well, we can now do this anywhere in 3D space. And you do it by basically simulating the changes to sound that happens when it's being heard by your ears. Could talk for a long time about HRTFs and the technology of how it works and all the rest.
Well, that's the next episode. How's that?
Yeah, filtering and EQ and different types of things. But just like we can make a sound distorted or have more bass or sound like it's far away with reverb, we have the capability through DSP to position a sound in anywhere in 3D space. So that's spatial audio. And the idea here is now that if you were mixing a record, just like you have a knob to position how far you want it between the left speaker and the right speaker, now you have this like control that lets you place that sound anywhere you want in 3D space around the listener. You can make it sound really far away. You can put it behind him, above him, below him. Great, you know, for what that's worth. So that's what spatial audio basically is. In terms of Stephen Desper, I talked to him quite a bit about this stuff back in the day. It's been a while. So if I get some of these details wrong, I'm sure someone will find it on the internet. But he was basically a tinkerer and was just exploring some of the stuff that you could do in the recording studio. And he kind of stumbled on this effect by accident. And he demonstrated it for me a couple of different ways. So you guys are both pretty experienced producers and engineers, and you're probably familiar with the idea of, like, I'm going to take a track, maybe like a snare drum track, and I want to make this snare punchier. So I'm going to make a copy for a send of this snare drum, and I'm going to route it into a particular effects chain, right? Maybe you're heavily gating it, and then you're going to put a bunch of reverb on it or some distortion or an envelope follower, but basically making an affected copy of the snare that you're going to mix back in with the original so that it hits a little harder or sounds different or better, right? Mm-hmm. So Desper was experimenting with doing those sorts of things and basically stumbled across this 500 hertz band pass filter with one side rotated slightly out of phase. And he's like, oh my God, I can hear sound coming from beyond the speaker. And that was basically it. He refined this thing over the years and kind of narrowed down what it took to achieve the effect with like the maximum amount of benefit for the minimum amount of effort. And that was what the core spatializer technology was. It was the kind of guy he was. He had all different kinds of ideas about different things you could do. And I just remember him, I was in that demo room at AID, and he came in, and he was a really quirky dude, but he was like talking to me about the mix that I was listening to or something. And he's like, oh, well, you know, you should pan this thing to the left a little bit more. And I said, well, I can't because the mix is done. He's like, oh, watch this. And he, you know, patches some cables in the board and found like the frequency band for this guitar or whatever and molted, you know, the mix on a channel and just turns this pan knob. And I swear to God, in this completed two-track mix, the guitar all of a sudden goes whoop and is moved over to the left. And he goes, well, there, how about that? Wow. Turns around and walked out. And I was like, okay, now I see how this stuff works.
Very cool.
Yeah, and that's the whole, I remember when he was around and the whole conversation around, you know, psychoacoustics, you know, like the effect of the brain, you know, the effect this stuff has on the brain, and it's an illusion. All of it's an illusion anyway, but like really this sort of extra realm, perceived realm that we're having now with these audio, because I've heard stuff sent to me that is just standard stereo, and in the hands, you know, of a fantastic producer and engineer, I hear stuff behind me. I hear stuff above me. I mean, it's just like the whole spectrum, you know, which still with just stereo audio, and it still blows my mind, you know, just like what's, I mean, I don't think we're done sort of mining the stereo world. I love the idea because I'm a tinkerer as well. I wouldn't say I'm an inventor. I have some friends who are inventors, and they're like way out beyond in those worlds trying to solve problems that maybe we don't have yet, or maybe we do have now, you know, like Ken Gores. You remember Ken Anu? Yeah, Ken's one of those guys. He doesn't really think of himself as he thinks of himself as an inventor, and I can totally get that. Guy's really brilliant in solving problems. He solved so many problems, and just with, you know, the studio spaces that I've had, you know, he'd come over and he'll just like, I'll go, yeah, the bass is really weird in here, and he'll just be like, help me move your desk, and we move the desk out 2 inches, and he's like, I brought these with me, and they're like, you know, those little beads of, you know, plastic or glass that you like stick in a fishbowl and you stick a plant in it. He'll put like some of those under the speakers, and then my bass issue just disappears. It's 90% gone, and I'm like, how the fuck did you do that? He's like, you know, I just experiment. I'm an inventor. And it's that kind of thinking, you know, to solve these problems. And like, I don't know if we have a problem. I mean, I'm sad that D is sad about the spatial audio reality.
Here's the thing.
Who knows how it's going to go?
Here's the thing with me, fellas. The spatial audio, the concept of it and hearing it, resonates with me because, you know, like you guys, I'm sure a lot of times part of my thing, like getting all the way back to what Anu was talking about with projects and getting into the practice of accomplishment. Part of my practice is like in the background, I tend to like play things back in my head, like constantly. And I pick things apart in my head. And sometimes when I'm thinking about a song that I'm working on, or I'm thinking about a song or a collection of music that's maybe something along the lines of what I'm trying to do, I will play that stuff back in my head, and I can visualize the room. I can kind of visualize the individual parts and close my eyes and look around and hear those things. And spatial audio to me, when it's working at its best, kind of does that. It kind of maps to the way I think about music in my head. All of the stuff about stereo aside, all of the trade-offs and what have you, there's something about it that just kind of mirrors the way I break music apart in my brain, you know? So I don't know if, you know, maybe like Michael said, maybe just improvements to stereo is the answer, but like, I don't know about you, Anu, but like when I'm working on stuff, I'm always thinking about like, what is the thing that's going to replace the experience of getting an album and bringing it home and picking through it and having all the cool artwork and reading the lyrics while I'm listening to the record. With the advent of streaming audio, like people have tried many, many things. Lots of people have tried many, many things, but they're like, it doesn't seem like anybody's really landed on something that makes music special again that way.
Well, I think that this is a great thing to dive into a little bit. So, because I'm interested in a lot of these same things. So a couple of points. First of all, it's worth noting that there's different types of music, right? And some music absolutely could benefit from spatial audio, but you know, yes. Like, person with a guitar or person with a piano is probably not that, right? Arguably those records would be just fine in mono. And you have to start looking at more elaborate productions where you even start to see the benefit of stereo, of getting more separation or creating a soundscape that isn't just sort of a picture of an audio picture of somebody playing live, right? So if you start talking about more elaborate audio productions, whether it's like Pink Floyd or electronic music or like some of the industrial stuff that you've done, you absolutely could do some very cool things with spatial audio. And we'll come back to that content piece in a second. But I think it's worthwhile taking a look at streaming services for a moment as an example of some of the content production problems that I talk about. So these streaming services have been around now for, you know, 20 years, right? And they are at this point the dominant way that people listen to music, right? People don't buy music anymore. They don't even really listen to the radio. They listen to streaming services. And yet, when you look at these streaming services, what does the album experience consist of? If you're lucky, you have like 1,000 pixel by 1,000 pixel JPEG of the front cover of the album and copyright information and a track list. There's no credits. There's no liner notes, none of that stuff. A couple years ago, and even to some degree today, it's been fashionable to blame the subscription services for that. It's not the subscription services' fault. It's
not.
It's the label's fault. It's the artist's fault because they are not providing these assets in any way. But nobody has seemed to care, aside from a handful of artists who have made some noises about it. So if the general public doesn't care, it's not coming through the streaming services. And even if you added spatial audio, I would argue that, you know, the streaming services do have spatial audio now. You can sit there and put your headphones on and sit back and close your eyes and experience a record beginning to end. But I don't think most people listen like that. There was a moment, maybe I have to go back and look at my notes, but it's like 10 years ago when Apple and a couple of other companies briefly were toying around with a more sophisticated album experience where they were going to have little flash apps for albums that had liner notes and things like that in there. But
I remember that. Yeah. Jay-Z did like a big thing like that. Bjork did one. And they were actually really cool.
Apple's initiative was called Cocktail. And there was a broader industry initiative called CMX. And I wrote in my blog that I knew that these things were going to fail. And they were going to fail because they were using proprietary platforms and because it was too much work for.
It's too much work. It's just way
too much work. And again, the audience just sort of doesn't care. The bulk of the audience doesn't care. Another thing that's happened with this digital stuff is like we're all of a certain age and clearly of a particular background that like this experience of holding the album, the vinyl album or even the CD and like looking through the booklet was like a window into a world that the album was, right? It's all a holistic piece. And one thing I'd note is that not all artists make records that way. There are plenty of great records that were just like whatever cover the label came up with and a plain paper sleeve or nothing on the inside of the CD booklet, and it was fine. And that not every listener cares about that stuff either. So I think it's a little bit niche. One exciting thing is that there's nothing stopping us as creators from building more elaborate things. We can make apps and publish them that run on phones or run on computers that are integrated with the audio experience. When I was at PlayStation, I did a lot of work with Sony Music and a guy named Brad Spar there, who's been working on a whole interactive music environment that is able to be supported by different artists. So there's still people experimenting and trying with this stuff. I just think there's not going to be a standard, and it's more likely that we'll be doing these interesting, like, art adjacent things. Like myself, I've been interested in this for a while, and that's why for a bunch of my records, I have made hardback books that actually accompany them.
Really?
Yeah. That have these very detailed liner notes and all these different things. And, you know, they're expensive as hell, but for me, it's like worth it because it's part of the art project. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I did. So I spent a few years doing this thing called the Mimeograph series. It's a longer story, but I felt I was stagnating with my writing, and I felt like I needed to try to do something that was gonna send me back to school. And the best way I could think to do it was to take stuff that I loved growing up and just learn it. And then the constraint that I placed on myself was, I'm gonna learn it, but I'm not gonna do it exactly the way they did it. I'm going to try to get back to whatever it was with them sitting down with a guitar or piano and just trying to do that. So I constrained myself to only using an upright bass, a hollow body electric, and a snare drum. And that was it. And I did three albums that way. But as part of the experiment, I started to write these chapbooks. And I got some help from the woman I was with at the time. Doing it didn't really work out. I mean, I still like to do it. I like the idea, and actually got a book deal that I ended up kind of flaking on because it was just too. Yeah. There's a publisher in town, University of Hell Press, and I met the guy, and I told him what I was doing, and he got really excited about it. And I showed him. I had this was done by the time I talked to him, and he gave me some notes, but. My grand vision was to do a book for each one of these albums. And I had done two of them. And by the time I got to the third one, the third album was such a pain in the ass to produce. And the writing was so time. It's such a time suck. It's a lot of like what you said about making the apps, about the app platform stuff. It's like just too much work. Ultimately, by the time I got done with the third album, I was fixing to write the book for that. By the time I got done with that album, I didn't want to do it anymore. Because I just wanted to make music. And I was finding myself spending so much time writing this stuff and then doing rewrites, you know, like getting notes from this guy. I said, I can't do it. I just want to make music.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this is
that's the, so cool though. This is the that's challenge so cool. Cause that was like my idea too.
With making this kind of enhanced content is you start to realize that like when you have a vision that is beyond just making the record, you realize that there's a lot more work that's involved creatively. This is why a lot of these, most artists have someone who designs their album covers for them. Right. But here's, so, you know, we're talking about some of the applications of this streaming stuff. And here's where it starts to get interesting for me. So I definitely surprise a lot of people when I say, hey, look, I think most people just don't care about music that much anymore. And part of it is like music is not central to the culture the way it used to be. Music has become a background or an additive to other things. And kids today they have a lot more distractions or a lot more sources of content, right? And it's YouTube videos and video games and things like that. And music is a component, but it's not the main dish. But that said, I am really interested in something. This is something I've been following for a year or two now, but I've also watched the rise of podcasts. And this was something we started talking about basically the minute they came on the scene with music subscription services, because licensing content for music services was prohibitively like business crushingly expensive. Podcasts yep. were free. And in the early days, back when like Adam Curry was calling himself the pod father and, you know, like
yeah,
met with him. And I used to describe podcasts back in 2010 as like content so bad you couldn't give it away for free. Things have changed now 10 years later, and people are really getting into this kind of basically like spoken word content. I mean, here we are making one, right?
Yes.
In a context where it's not radio, and it's not music, and it's not an audiobook. It's something else entirely. And so I've been hearing a couple of records that are kind of intersections of these things, where it's like, I'll send you guys some examples, but these records where it's like somebody talking or reading a story with music underneath, and it's not quite an audiobook, and it's not quite a record, and it's not quite spoken word. It is art, where it's like it's creating a mood or creating a vibe. And you kind of get into the space of what's happening, and these pieces go by. And for something like that, I think spatial audio could be great, because it's almost like a movie that you can listen to on your headphones. And just like you might watch a part of, I don't know, Blade Runner, not because you want to see the story, but just because you want to feel the vibe. That's what these new records or these new audio things are creating. So I'm contemplating making a record like that myself, that would allow this kind of more writerly description and a soundscape and something like that. And I think for that type of new content or something that's kind of heading in a different direction, spatial audio could be extremely compelling.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, what's that guy's name? Joe Frank. Did you ever listen to
Joe? I remember Joe. Oh my God, dude. Yeah.
This guy was way like 20, 30 years ago. And there's a new one. It's really like Orson Welles all over again. It's, you know, it's like radio. They paint this, they make a total movie with these episodes that are all kind of podcast-ish. But there's one called, I think it's called Night Vale. And it's this really supernatural, spooky story every week. And it, for some reason, it still creeps me out every time I listen to it. Or like, it's kind of like Black Mirror, but for radio sort of idea, but with music and, you know, episodic kind of events, you know, where these like, there's this new, you know, supernatural threat to this town that's constantly in darkness. And like, you know, the people that live there, I love that idea. That's really like, you know, I think that's where a lot of this stuff is really going to be going, because like you got to find new formats and ideas for these things. But also you can look back at like Joe Frank. I was always hypnotized when I would hear his stuff on the radio. I had to stop, because you got
Joe Frank was the shit, dude. Larry turned me on to Joe Frank.
Yeah, and unfortunately he passed away, but all his stuff is archived, and I think you can get it online now. I think his wife is managing that whole thing. And that's kind of what you described, Anu. I mean, it's just like, but if you did it as a kind of an album format, like almost like a performance, a captured performance, I think that's really brilliant. I expect no less from you, though. So you got to step that up. Whatever's next.
Well,
we want to have.
Yeah. So Anu is posting a whole bunch of stuff that we're going to share with people. Among that stuff is the things that we're going to turn you on to, some of the things that he's found. Oh, John Fox did something like this.
Wow. Yeah, he was.
Nice.
When I heard the John Fox record and the Will Burns and Hannah Peel record, that was when it really sparked for me. And I was like, okay, there's something going on here. And, you know, I find it interesting because in some ways, like I love writing songs, right? But as I think both of you guys do, but in some ways there's an aspect of it that it's just like, well, so what? You know, like done that before, and everybody's doing it, and everybody's got their stupid songs, and what people want out of songs in some ways is so degraded or so different now than what it used to be. And this idea of a different kind of storytelling for a different kind of listener is really compelling to me. Perhaps in some ways I'm a frustrated writer, perhaps, or I should spend more time actually like writing trying to figure out fancy chords for my little pop songs. But there's also just the idea of like, I'm very like Scott Walker. I consider myself kind of restless as an artist, and I'm always looking for different things to do or different ways to challenge myself. And I'm kind of compelled by this idea.
Oh, you dude, I would encourage you to do it.
I think it's great.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I think there's always room for the, you know, new ideas and new technology out there. And it's just a matter of like how how are we going to twist it into something that's kind of new? And to Anu's point about like, who cares? Well, we care. And I'd be interested, if it's something I'm interested in, and I'm, you know, I live in Los Angeles, relatively cynical about a lot of this stuff, but I'm also super hopeful because there's always something new where someone thinks of something like you just suggested. And I'm like, of course, that would be great, you know, and then start to express it and sort of, you know, see if it has legs. And, but we're not, you know, we're not Apple Corp, you know, we're not trying to like, how do we get dollars out of this? It's like, we do it because it's a sickness for us. We have to do it. We're compelled to do it kind of no matter what. So finding interesting ways to entertain ourselves, I think, is kind of part of it from what I hear from all of us.
Yeah, to pull a lot of these threads together. I mean, back in the late 90s, when I started thinking about a lot of these pieces that were starting to come together, you know, we were all in the early 90s struggling because it was like there were all these gates that we had to get through, right? You had to get signed so that someone would give you enough money that you could go into a real studio to make a decent record and have it mastered and pressed and then distributed. And that gate would then get you to like, well, can I get it on MTV or on the radio or somehow get it heard? And then maybe I can have a career making music. And this was all these hurdles or gates you had to get through to even get your record made and get it out there for people to potentially not like, right? And a lot of the things that I and other people in the industry were working on were ways to change that. And the good news is there was tremendous success. And by the end of the 90s, you know, you instead of going to the record plant, you could go and buy an ADAT or a DA88 and a Mackie mixer and start making your own records, right? I think, D, you made your record on a couple of ADATs, if I'm not mistaken.
Did, yeah. And, thanks to Michael and the good folks at AID.
Yeah, and so then the first thing you start to realize is like, well, I actually now have to learn about microphone placement and tracking and mixing and all the rest of this stuff. But access becomes democratized. And within just a few years, even ADATs and DA88s became obsolete. And now it's like, well, all you need is a computer and you can do everything on the computer. And in the world we're in today, now people are doing it all literally on their phones, like free instruments and doing multi-tracking and stuff on their phones and making records for basically $0 of production. And the other thing that happened is that we made it so that now you can distribute your record for free. You can go to any one of a number of digital distribution companies and upload your files and push a button and your music is going to be available globally within minutes for whatever price you want, including zero. And it's also going to get stolen by some Russians and put up there for $0. And we now also have these playback systems like Apple Music and Spotify and Tidal, where all of the music in the world, more or less, is, or you can Google it if it's not on there, but all the music that you can imagine is at your fingertips. So all those gates that were stopping people like us from making our music and getting it out there are gone. On the minus side, because all those gates are gone, everyone is making records. And so there's just this ocean of content, most of which is not very good, to sift through. And every year, you know, there's, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand, half a million new records that come out, and they're competing against the Beatles and Nine Inch Nails and your record and the half a million records that came out the year before. And it just gets tougher and tougher to wade through. It's no surprise that in retrospect, it's no surprise that what's happened is like the biggest stars have become even bigger because they are the ones that are standing above this sea of content. And people gravitate towards listening to those big stars, not just because they are marginally better or not than the rest of the ocean, but just because they're familiar names. You know who to search for or you know what to click on. And so there's become this real winner-take-all thing. And it takes me back to, well, why are we doing this in the first place? And for me, it's like, I don't know that I ever really thought I was going to be, you know, a financially successful musician. I just wanted to make records and get them out there. And good news is I can do that now. I'm probably not going to make any money at it, but that's okay. That's not really what I wanted anyway. I'm doing it for me and for you.
Yeah, same. I mean, the most I ever hoped for was just to be able to carve out some semblance of a living doing it, which didn't happen, but I still get to do it. Thanks to the advancements of technology. Thanks in no small part to everything you just outlined, all the advancements in technology, I can still do it. We all can.
It's interesting because like the person who introduced me to, making music on a computer was Anu. Because I remember I called him, I said, I got a little chunk of money and I think I'm going to buy some gear, you know? And he said, and I told him what gear I was going to get. And he said, let me make a suggestion to you. He said, have you heard of Cubase, you know, and have you heard of computers, you know, and all that stuff. And like back then, I don't even think I had a computer at that point, you know, maybe my girlfriend had one at the time, and he made the suggestion, you know, to go to computer-based audio recording. And I listened and I spent the money on this. I did the research and sort of found out what to do and what to buy. And then I got it. And then I spent a month going like, I never should have fucking listened to Anu because this is so difficult. I was so mad at my computer.
That mother sucker Anu.
That mother that guy. Sucker. And then I finally sat down and started to like plug everything in and sort of go, oh, okay, this isn't so hard. You know, like this, that's not, I'm like calling Anu going, like, how do you do that thing again? So anyway, I got started on it. And that just opened my whole world. I wouldn't be doing any mastering, I don't think. I wouldn't have had any of those chops to even begin to learn what that was. Because, you know, anyway, so kudos and thank you to Mr. Anu for that tip and for my dumb ass for listening and then getting into it. Because it's been, you know, changed my world for sure. So,
well, he's been mastering and mixing most of the stuff that I've done for the last 20 years. So I should thank you, too.
Well,
he's
done my records as well. And it was, you know, I grew up with computers and was reasonably familiar with them, but I hadn't really thought about using computers for audio until I went to do some tracks with one of the guys in my band, a guy named Chris Futerich, who is a producer and engineer, worked on Not a Surf's Let Go, among other things. And we did.
Oh, I love that album.
Yeah, he
that's a great album.
He did a real nice job on that. He's done a bunch of things. You can look him up on the All Music or whatever. But I went over to his apartment in LA to work on some songs, and he was using Pro Tools, and I'd never seen a DAW up close in person. And it was one of those things where literally after 5 minutes, I was just kicking myself, going, "I am such an idiot. Here I am. I've been struggling, you know, like." Cassette 8-tracks or whatever for years and years and years. And I'm just watching this guy like comp vocals and move tracks around. And I'm like, oh my God, this is just like a word processor for audio. I totally get this. This can't be that hard. And it was a light bulb moment. Immediately went and got the stuff. And all three of us have experienced that of like, yeah, it's a little bit of a burden, but then you immediately see the power of this thing of like, oh my God, you mean I don't have to spend $2,000 on a rack space compressor that I can now send one signal through in my mixing board? I can buy a plug-in version and I can instantiate as many as I want? No way! It just, my brain is still reeling from all the things that I could be doing with these tools.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, you know, it goes all the way back to like, so I've only actually been in a proper studio twice in my entire life. That said, I spent a lot of time, most of what I've learned about music production happened in a little studio in Garden Grove that this friend of ours, Danny Kearney, ran out of his garage, and he had like an Atari track, he had a little mixer. And we did most of the bands that I was in for the duration of the 80s, into the early 90s, but prior to Penal Colony, recorded there. And even going back to those days, like we would try to do things and we would have like maybe one digital reverb. We would just go like, and we would just sit there just like just getting pissed and going, having to do like something special or having to burn reverb into a track and going, fuck, if only. Like we were like, even way back then, we're like going, if only we had some way to do this thing. And so we were just thinking about it constantly. So by the time Larry, I would, you know, I told the story in an episode I'm sure you heard, you know, Larry got an Atari 1040 and that was, and then not long after that, like Cubase came out with Cubase Audio and I think they were doing that for the Atari or maybe it was on a Mac by the time they introduced Cubase Audio. I can't remember, But it was like, you know, as soon as it happened, it was like, oh, thank God. It's fine. It's the dream realized. It's finally happening.
Yeah. Finally, I can use all 150 tracks that I've been thinking about.
Well,
yeah. Speaking of 150 tracks, I think we're like pushing on time here.
We're going. We're marathon mode. Because it's Anu. It's Anu.
Well, I'm certainly happy to come back again if you guys want.
Oh, please. Please.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're 2 hours, which is marathon for us.
We may have to split this episode and then do another one.
Well, we might have to.
Are you good with next week?
Sure. Absolutely. Happy to come back whenever you guys want, and we can focus the discussion a little bit more. I mean, there's a lot to unpack. And the thing that I think is so great about what you guys are doing is I do think that you have a lot of people who are listening, and, you know, with the title being Music, Mindfulness, and Madness, there's all this stuff in here about, like, what does it mean to be creative, and how do you work that creative practice into your adult life, and how do you balance all the problems that we have as we get older with all of those things. And I think it's a great concept, and I'm glad to be here and be a little guest on it today.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
Woo!
Michael, once again, I've dropped the ball. I don't have my oblique strategies cards in front of me. Do you have yours in front of you?
He's got them. Anu brought his
own. Anu has some? Yes!
I mean, I knew I was going to like this podcast when you guys started talking about this.
We do this all the time. One of us forgets, and then you've heard the other one has to talk while we run and get the box. Well, but you have one.
Got one right in my hands.
Oh, dude, God love you.
Here you go.
What do you got?
Remove ambiguities and convert to specifics.
I love it.
So what does that mean to you, Anu?
Well, one way you could think about it in the context of today's conversation is commit, right? If you have an idea that you're going to do something, maybe it's, I'm going to put this part down, or I'm going to make a record about blah, blah, blah. Stop thinking about it and do it. You have to, as I'm fond of saying in my songwriting class, start and then make it better. So take your ideas and start to make them real. That's how I would interpret it for today.
Salient. Yeah, I'm literally in the middle of, but before we started this, I've got, you know, there's always one black sheep in the batch, right? One or two. There's one, you know, there's always one or two when you're working on an album that goes where it's like a smudge of an idea, but you need to get it out and come back to it and then see if you can do anything with it. I had one like that I ended up having to throw away that I just kept trying to nurture and trying to do different things with, and I just couldn't make it happen. I've got one right now that's in that same kind of place where it's like there's ambiguities. I kind of have a fuzzy idea of what I want to do with it, but I'm at the point where I need to push the ambiguities out of the way and just get to it, you know?
Well, I'm super excited about this. Thank you so much, Anu, for coming in today, for showing up from beautiful San Francisco, California.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, man.
I guess the usual salutations and outros here, just find all our stuff online. You know, we're on the Facebook, we're on Instagram.
Facebooks,
Instagrams. All the stuff. And we're going to pick up with Anu next week.
Very high tech in the presence of Anu.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anu. Yeah, we'll have some stuff next week to talk about for sure. If you can come back, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
All right, man. Okay. Howdy.